Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. This is Reservations, and I'm Rain Whalen.
And I'm the Lisan Al Gaib.
The Kwisatz Haderach.
That's right.
The Muad Adib.
That's right. Lisan Al Gaib, dude.
Switching HDMI 1 to HDMI 2.
I mean, when I walk into a room, Stilgar can't take his eyes off me.
Jesus Christ. For anyone who hasn't seen Dune Part 2 yet, that's not a spoiler. I'm sure you've probably seen a meme by now, but I think that's the funniest thing to come out of that movie, considering that movie's not funny.
Not even a week old. Well, and it's not even a week old, and people are just like, you know what I mean? Like, enough people saw it opening weekend. Like, we did, by the way, absolutely tremendous. Probably, well, it will go down in history as one of the greatest sequels of all time.
Absolutely. If we didn't speak enough about Dune Part 1 when that came out, Part 2 completed it completed the impossible task of outdoing the first. I saw a review because I saw like a TV spot where I guess they were getting fan reviews, and one fan said, "This must have been what it was like to see Star Wars for the first time in theaters." And I was like, "Damn, that's high praise."
Deservedly so, I would say.
Especially considering that for those of you who don't know, Dune predates Star Wars, so
that's true.
So in case you didn't figure it out, Jeremy and I saw Dune Part 2. Not together, unfortunately. But yeah, shit was rad, dude. Dude, it was so fucking good, bro.
God. It was great. The visuals are spectacular. The story is, I mean, Denis just puts you in, no safety net, you know. We took his hand and he brought us along to introduce everyone in the first one, but here you let our hand go and let's go. Like
I love that this isn't a spoiler, everyone, but it picks up right where the first one left off.
Yeah.
Like no previously on, like no catching us up. We're right where we left off. Like it's
amazing. It was truly great. I mean, it's already in the top 10 on Letterboxd for the 250 narrative films. Like it surpassed The Godfather.
What?
Yeah.
Dude, Francis Ford Coppola is probably pissed.
Don't worry. It's still behind The Godfather Part 2. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's fine. Coppola still got one in there, but I mean, and I think just because, you know, it's a, obviously this app is new. I mean, it's, you know, it's new technology. So, people don't really interact with older films like that. And so when a new film comes out and everyone sees it and everyone loves it, it's going to, you know, surpass, you know, older films on the app because more people are interacting with that page. Right, so, I mean, it's not like we're saying, or Letterboxd is saying it's better than, it's just, it has more interactions and it has more 5-star reviews or whatever, but, amazing. I guess that's our first recommendation of the episode is go see Dune Part 2.
go see Dune Part 2.
Yeah.
And also, everyone, sorry for the delay in the episode. We really didn't discuss it off mic, but this will probably be out tomorrow with the video.
I mean, it doesn't matter, but especially those of you in the future.
I was not feeling good yesterday when we normally record. I had the worst, I guess I would say, migraine of my life. I don't usually get migraines. I don't really know what brought it on. I don't know if I was dehydrated. I don't know if my blood sugar was low. It felt like someone, if you're watching the episode, it felt like someone was grabbing here on my head, on my temples, and just squeezing the fuck out of my head. Like, oof. And I couldn't keep my eyes open. Like, I just, it was rough. And then what really sucked is it came in waves. So like, I eventually told Ashley, like, I gotta lay down. Like, once we agreed that we would delay the episode, I was like, I gotta lay down. Like, I have to be in a dark room. So I went into our bedroom, turned off all the lights. I even put on one of Ashley's sleep masks because that's how bad it was. And then my head would stop and I'd feel pressure and then it would come back. And it just, and I told Ashley, like, I was like, I could deal with the pressure. Pressure, because like it had been slow building all day. So like the pressure I could have dealt with, but the pain, Jesus. But then, yeah, after I ate, took some meds, I started to feel a little better. And then today I feel great. So
that's good.
Yeah. I don't know. It was weird. Yeah. I'm also wearing my Epcot shirt today that I got at Disney with the Epcot ball.
The Epcot ball.
With the Epcot ball. just because it's a little chilly in the media room. So
is it?
This is what they call a spirit jersey. So like on the sleeves, it's got. You know, so this specifically has like the rides. So like there's I don't see any of the rides on the sleeve. Oh, well, there's the monorail right there. But on the chest part. Oh, yeah, there's Olaf right there.
Jesus.
Anyway, point being, I'm in my Epcot shirt and yeah. But anyway, so sorry for the delay in the episode, everyone, but we hope you enjoy this one. I feel like this one's going to be a doozy, my man.
Yeah. I mean, no, it's going to be a bunch of fun. I love this movie, so it's going to be fun to talk about, I think.
So Jeremy, would you like to tell everyone, what we're discussing today?
Sure.
Your final pick of the season.
That's right. Before we go on to our end of season series. Today we are discussing, Jeremy Saulnier's, Jeremy Saulnier's revenge film Blue Room.
So this was a first watch for me, and I've got a lot I want to talk about. But first impressions, it was really good. Mm-hmm. You know, after I finished the movie, I read that MTV called it the benefit of what crowdfunding can achieve. Because I guess it was crowdfunded on Kickstarter. And it's pretty, like, knowing that and seeing the film, like, it's, you're like, this was crowdfunded, people like donated money so this film could get made, and it's does not disappoint. You got an email, buddy.
I know, sorry.
But yeah, it doesn't disappoint, and it was not what I was expecting either, which is a good thing.
Yeah, no, for real. So a quick synopsis before we get started. Macon Blair, who I'm not related to, unfortunately, is Dwight. Dwight seemingly is a homeless person just trying to survive out on the streets. He lives in his car, which is an old blue beat up Pontiac. And one day he gets invited to the police station by a police officer that he seems to know and that she seems to know him. Meaning that, you know, he's been out here for a while. Right. Mm-hmm. And she let him know that the man who killed his parents, or was charged for killing his parents, was released from prison. And that seems to be all that he needs to hear to take some action. So almost as if he's been planning for it. So he gasses up his car. He leaves the area he was living in, and he goes to track down the man who killed his parents. And in doing so, he ends up killing that man. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This, however, sets in motion a domino effect that will not only affect him, but affect his sister and his nieces in the process. So after he kills Wade Jr., he escapes in their car, and goes to find his sister. Okay. once he realizes that this murder was not put on television, was not, you know, had any media attention, he realizes they didn't call the police, which means they're after him and after her, right? So both the car and his sister's address are linked. And so because he left the car at the bar, they know exactly where he is, right? Or they know where to find his sister anyway. So again, this leads into this like cat and mouse chase. He ends up kidnapping one of Wade's family members to get some information to make sure that his sister will be safe. He runs in, he finds his old high school buddy who he knows has a lot of guns and knows that he'll help him out when he's in a jam, right? Friend helps him out. Dwight tracks down Wade's family, where they live, and traps him in a corner. Violence ensues. And does anybody win? Does anybody truly get the revenge they were seeking? Tough to say. But that is Blue Ruin. So, in a nutshell.
Yeah.
So, I think where this film is pitch perfect is in its realism, right?
I agree.
Nothing is more grounded than this film, especially in its, in sort of the way that grief will overtake someone, because really it hits Dwight so hard, right? Or it must have, right? We have that assumption that Dwight has been overcome by this grief for years, decades. And it seems that, and I like that we have this sister character, because it didn't, it affected her, but not as much. She seemed to sort of live with the guilt and live with the grief and still function in society, where Dwight completely just disassociates with society. And what I love about this story is that we're getting some information and we're piecing things together that make perfect sense, but they're not explicit. Like, the car was probably the car that they were murdered in, which is why there are bullet holes all over the car, right? Which is why the car is linked to the house, because the house is their house that they grew up in, right? Which means the sister inherited the house, or they both did, and Dwight, you know, again, just vanishes and goes off on his own, and his sister stays, right? And again, we're inferring all of this stuff. We're piecing it all together, but it's not really explicit, right?
Yeah, I was about to say, because, like, yeah, it never registered with me that there were bullet holes in the car. I just assumed that, you know, since Dwight was living as a vagrant, passerbys, you know, used it as an easy target or something like that.
Yeah, no, I think we're supposed to assume that it was his parents' car.
That would track, considering I did have to look up when his parents were murdered, that it had been 20 years since his parents were murdered. And that Pontiac is definitely, like, I think the key said like 80s or 90s Pontiac 90. Or something like that.
It was like a 1990 Pontiac.
Yeah. So that would track.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And so, like, that's, and it's fascinating that that's, he chooses to hold on to where they were murdered. Right. Essentially, like, he's not letting that go. Right. Much like he's not letting any of it go. And just his sheer passion for vengeance and his unwillingness to back down and to let them get away with it, right? even when he finds out that maybe it was Big Wade that killed his parents in the first place, it wasn't even the guy who was charged with the murder. Which was a big
deal. I definitely want to talk about later, but
sure.
Yeah, you know, to kind of piggyback off of you, I really loved the realism and how grounded it was, you know. Like, let's kind of look at another one of our revenge films that we've done. You Were Never Really Here.
Okay.
I do feel like that one was a little bit more, not fantastical in a way. It was grounded. You know, Lynn Ramsey definitely grounded it. But it did seem like Joaquin Phoenix's character was kind of superhuman in a way. Mm-hmm. As where Dwight is so, I'm going to be honest. You said his name is pronounced as Macon Blair.
That's how I've heard it. I've read it as Macon Blair, but every time I hear someone say it, either in a video or like when he's being introduced or whatever, it's Macon. So
Macon. Okay. Yeah. Well, when he shaves his beard and cuts his hair, he looks a lot like Joe Latrugo. He kind of looks a little bit like Charles Boyle a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, I feel like that works for keeping this film so real and so grounded that he's just a normal guy. You know, he's a normal guy who wants revenge, who to a certain extent wants justice for his parents. And then wants just to return to a normal life, I would assume. Honestly, I assume that he was ready to go to prison. Which is why I think he cut his hair and shaved his beard, because he wanted to look, I guess, respectable. It's just the whole time I was watching it, I was like, man, this is so real.
There's nothing special about Dwight, right? Mm-hmm. Dwight is just like, he feels that with this revenge, with his vengeance, with the murder of Wade, to balance the scales, he thinks that's going to make him feel better, right? That's mm-hmm. what all revenge films are like. That's what all revenge stories are like, is they think it's going to make them feel better. They think it's going to take that grief away and that pain away, and it never does. And so in this case, which is really interesting, is that this film is kind of, in a way, very anti-violence. It's also very anti-gun also. In many ways, and we can get to that in a little bit, but with it being this anti-violence, it's violence begets violence, right? Nothing, it'll never solve any of it, right? Because, you know, he kills Wade, fine, but there's like six others that are going to come after him and Sam, right? His sister.
Mm-hmm.
Until he kills another one and then another one. And then what if they kill Sam or kill one of the girls or, you know, kill within one, right? And it's just going to be, you know, just this vicious cycle, right? Just round mm-hmm. and round until someone breaks it. And that's what's so fascinating about the end of the film with William, that he lets it go. And mm-hmm. we are to assume that William is the outcome of the affair between Dwight's dad and Wade's dad, or Wade's mom. I think that's what we're to assume, is that William belongs to both families.
I think Dwight says that he's my father's son.
Okay, yeah. So,
sorry, I wanted to piggyback again off your cycle of violence, because I don't think you'll be mad at me about the comparison I'm about to make.
We'll see.
But it did remind me a lot of The Last of Us Part 2 specifically, because that's what Part 2 is all about, is this cycle of violence until someone breaks it.
Yeah.
Now, The Last of Us, of course, Part 2 did something different where the person who is enacting their revenge, Ellie, is the one who decides to break it. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't technically get her revenge, but that's because she finally realizes it's better just to let it go. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's interesting that William, and I think it's because William, we get kind of established early on, kind of doesn't like this family. You know, when they pick up Wade from prison, he doesn't want to get out of the limo. You know, that we see them try to tug his arm and he just wants to stay in the limo. So we kind of get our first kind of clue that William's different, at least. At least that's how I took it.
Yeah, William is, I mean, he is a physical manifestation of what started all of this, right? He's the reminder of all of it. He's the constant. He's the consequence, right? Mm-hmm. And which is fascinating. So, and we don't get a lot from William, right? We get a little bit. That first interaction with William and Dwight is, I mean, tremendous. You know, did you hurt Wade? Wade hurt my parents. I don't think he did. Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, there is no praise good enough for what Macon Blair is doing here. Okay. His subtlety, his restraint, his sort of his naivete is perfect, right? Mm-hmm. Because like he doesn't know what he's doing, but he's driven to do so. And so like when he makes a mistake, I mean, it's, here's a comparison that, I mean, you don't have a frame of reference for, and neither does probably anyone listening to this. There's a German horror film called Angst. I'm sure I've mentioned it before. That means fear. And it's about a serial killer who goes and kills this family in this house. But it's showing the painstaking parts of murdering people. So he kills them, but then he has to drag their bodies somewhere. And it's just reminding you, or like letting you know, that killing someone is really hard. And like, that's how I felt like with Dwight, right? Like when Dwight is doing something, like it's hard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like when he stabs Wade in the bathroom, obviously it's not perfect because he's not an assassin. You know, he's not a trained killer. Yeah. He doesn't know what he's doing. Him slicing his hand open, trying to slash the tires because it slipped on the, I mean, you know what I mean? These are him leaving his key, right? I mean, you feel for him, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, you're just like, he's so out of his element. He doesn't know how to do these things, but he feels that it's necessary for him to move on. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Even at a point where he's like, there is no moving on, you know, but he needs to finish it. And especially at the end, he's like, I'm planning on dying doing so. Dwight is such a fascinating character study on revenge and violence and vengeance.
Yeah, because we, I mean, yes, we're following Dwight, but, you know, he's not, you know, he's, I mean, I guess in terms of like scripting, you could say he's our protagonist, but, you know, he's not our hero, you know. And I also find that interesting that the guy we're following, yes, we're maybe supposed to empathize with him, especially when it comes to wanting to protect Sam. But, you know, there is kind of a disconnect as like, it's like, well, I can't relate to someone who wants to get revenge and kill someone, you know. Well,
and it's his fault he needs to protect Sam in the first place.
That's true. Yeah. Had his key not fallen off, this movie would have only been 30 minutes long.
Well, and not only that, but he didn't have to go kill Wade.
That's true. Know? He could have just let it go.
And again, this whole thing is based on a misunderstanding because he assumes Wade Jr. killed his parents because he went to jail for it. But that wasn't the case, right? It was Wade Sr.
Mm-hmm.
who killed Dwight's parents.
Yeah. Now, I do like that even the Wade's family, his older brother, Teddy, when Dwight says, "What about my mother?" And he goes, "Okay, there, I'll agree that was a fuck up." Because his mom was just collateral damage. They right. just wanted to kill Wade's father.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's like, well, you know, why did your father feel like the need to kill my father? You know, mm-hmm. why? Yeah. Like that doesn't even answer the question.
Well,
and
it brings up what we've spoken about before, like with Place Beyond the Pines. It's generational trauma at this point because mm-hmm. we have their parents who, you know, they were having an affair and then, you know, Wade Sr. enacted this revenge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Accidentally killed both, right? And then that led to, you know, Dwight and then Wade. Wade Jr. paying that price, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these consequences have generational effect.
Right.
Which is, you know, which again, something we've talked about before. It's like they're inheriting burden, they're inheriting pain. They're inheriting hate, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the opening to Once Upon a Time in the West, where Henry Fonda plays the bad guy, which back then was shocking because it was the first time he had ever played a bad guy, and he shoots down this whole family, but there was a boy in the house, and when he walked out of the house, he's maybe 10, 11, you know. And you think he's going to let him go. And then one of his guys is like, "No, can't let him go because then he's going to come after you." Right. And he's going to come mm-hmm. after your children. Right. It's the same thing. Right.
Yeah.
He kills that kid, by the way. That's how the movie opens. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. Because I thought of that too. I was like, you know, this all started because Big Wade wanted to kill Dwight's father.
Sure. You could argue that it was Dwight's dad and
Wade's yeah, wife, yeah. Right?
You could argue it started there with their affair. But what I like later on when Dwight goes to their house and is there for a couple of days.
Yeah.
He starts to see them as people and as a family and as human beings because he's mm-hmm. surrounded by them and who they are and like photographs and albums and you know memories and you know this house. And you know, I think then is when it really starts to sink in, you know, what they're doing and what is all of this worth, right? Mm-hmm. And of course it ends up killing him because then when he gets sort of this clarity and the fog of revenge starts to lift a little, that's when he starts making speeches. And that's, you know, that's going to get you killed according, you know, to his buddy.
Ben. Also, yeah. Shout out to Ben. I don't remember the actor's name, but that's fucking Buzz McAllister from Home Alone.
Yeah.
I was like, I know that face. And then after the movie was over, I was like, oh my God, it's fucking Buzz.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get to Ben in a second. Cause I want to spend like 2 hours on Ben.
okay.
But yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Cause then that's when he leaves the message. Like, mm-hmm. You killed two of mine. I killed two of yours. The way I see it, it's even. Mm-hmm. Let's just let this go. Leave my sister out of this. I'll back away if you back away. But of course, that brother, I can't think of that brother's name, is so gung ho, which also, man, talk about tension building. Shout out to our Sicario episode. Tension building. Wait, like Dwight's in the fucking house, got a gun on them with their backs turned. Like he could have easily just ended it.
Yeah.
Right then and there. But you're right. He's seeing them as people, as a family, and I'm sure somewhere deep down wanted to give them a chance.
Yeah, again, give them a chance. You know, he sees where this is leading, which is a never ending cycle, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's why he leaves the message. That's why he's talking to them the way he's talking to them, right? I mean, he kills one of them, before making his speeches, but that had to be done.
Yeah,
they weren't going to listen to him anyway. But yeah, I mean, again, this film is, you know, anti-violence, sort of like You Were Never Really Here was, which was a good comparison. I think sort of the realism aspect lends to that as well, showing mm-hmm. you true consequences of violence. And it even plays, so this movie, all right, this is how good Saulnier is at depicting realistic stories, is that An Arrow didn't seem so silly. I think maybe in another film that would have seemed sort of silly, this mm-hmm. guy shooting a crossbow. But these guys are hunters, right? So it's like they have guns, yeah. They have crossbows, and they probably have bow and arrows and they whatever. So makes sense. Like they're sort of like a country family.
Which is interesting that it's in Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I would have never suspected Pittsburghians. Well,
you know, they're out in the boonies, you know.
Well, it's like when I hear people say like, "Oh yeah, I'm from the backwoods of Florida," and I'm like, "What?"
Yeah, exactly. And so, and I was thinking to myself too. I'm like, well, maybe because it's quiet, you know. Mm-hmm. But the other guy has a shotgun.
Well,
the other guy's a shotgun, yeah, so yeah. It's like it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, dude. Like, Haley was laying on the couch with me and she was watching something on her phone. And when Dwight was trying to take it out,
oh my God,
I was like, listen, I know you're not watching it, but seriously, don't look up. Okay. Like, you're not going to like it. Yeah, it's gnarly, him trying to take the arrow out.
Yeah,
something that Sonia will, he'll make you squirm. In Green Room too. Green Room has some insane realism with its gore and its violence too.
Let's see, where is it?
Do you have Green Room? It's so good. If you haven't seen Green Room,
I'll find it later. Yeah, I have Green Room. I told Ashley we need to watch it because
it's great.
What fascinated me about that is I heard recently that Patrick Stewart said that the script disturbed him and that's why he agreed to do it.
He's great in it. Macon is also in it again. Anton Yelchin, it's one of his last movies.
Shout out to our boy.
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah. So back to the realism. Yeah, dude, right. That scene. Oh, God, it just absolutely, I was just like, oh, like I didn't look away, but I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. Cause you're right. You know, he doesn't know how to take out a barb. I mean, he's smart enough to try to get it down smaller. So he doesn't have this giant barb sticking out of his leg, but he doesn't know how to get it out. I wouldn't even know how to get it out, you know,
nope.
Until eventually he makes the right move to go to a hospital.
All right. So the part that is funny is him at the pharmacy where one of those one of those $1 bills had blood all over it, and he couldn't explain it, and he just didn't. And I did chuckle at that, because he's like, I don't know.
You could tell he's trying to think of an excuse, and then he's just like, and walks away.
I mean, if I were the cashier, I wouldn't have said anything either. So it's, you know, I like the juxtaposition between Dwight living this homeless lifestyle, right? At the beginning of the film, he's got his really long hair, he's got his beard, and he looks like a different person. And when he shaves it off, it is sort of this jarring moment, because he does, I mean, he has transformed himself into, you know, a different person. And it's almost like he's being, not reborn in a way, but he's sort of like, he's in that moment, obviously he's trying to evade capture, because, you know, who are they going to be looking for? A guy with a long hair and a long beard, right? Mm-hmm. But in another sense, because it's after he killed Wade, that he's sort of cleansing himself a little bit. He's sort of letting himself, you know, go back to normal in a way.
Yeah.
Even though he does have this hanging, these hanging threads to deal with, which is the family, right? Like, he still needs to deal with that. Obviously at that point he doesn't realize the scope of it, and, you know, like, they're truly after him, but I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah. Now, I will say, you know, just singing the praises of how grounded the film was, I will say it is interesting that he does sort of almost kind of know that they're coming after him, mm-hmm. you know, when he's sitting at the diner with Sam. You know, it did feel like a stretch that he would just suddenly be like, they didn't go to the cops.
Well, yes and no, because I see what you're saying, but also it's a great story element to, it makes sense, which I also really like, that if the car belongs to their parents and the house belongs to their parents, technically, right? Mm-hmm. The registration of the car belongs to that address, right? And so, since they're connected in that sense, and that's obviously where his sister lives, then I think it completely made sense to me, because, you know, it's like him having a sudden realization, you know, because he checked the TV before he left, whose ever house that was. And there's nothing on the news. There's, you know, no investigation going on. No one's gone to the cops. No one's called it in, whatever. When he goes to visit his sister, and when he's letting her know all the stuff that's happened, and I think that's when he realizes, you know, if they didn't go to the cops, that means they're probably, you know, and then of course the car is there. So they have the car to link to the address. It made perfect sense to me. No.
I'm not saying that. It just almost kind of like a, I don't know why this is the only thing that's coming to mind, but like a John Wick situation where he kind of like figures out like, oh my God, they're coming after me now.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing. Yeah.
And it sort of does seem that way, you know, in sort of typical action film trope, is that there are multiple people after one person. Right. Which, yes, can seem to be a little, like a little melodramatic, or, you know, suspending of disbelief.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know what I mean? But
yeah. But I mean, it didn't take me out of it. I just, like I said, I just found it kind of interesting that it seems like Dwight would have these moments of like, oh, I know what's going on.
Right.
But then other scenes he'd be like, you know, kind of naive and like, you know, like, you know, so like, you know, you're every man, but again, it didn't take me out of it. There's something else I was going to add. I forgot.
Well, this could be a good way to transition to speaking of his naivete and his sort of everyman status. is when he meets up with Ben, right? Mm-hmm. Ben being a he was based on someone Sonya went to high school with, like he which I like. Honestly, like it'd be like if we were in a jam like that, we needed someone with an artillery, we would just, I don't know if you knew Davis in high school, we would just call Davis. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? It's sort of the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it is interesting that, you know, well, not really interesting, but I think it's kind of funny that he remembers like, oh yeah, this one guy from high school, he's going to hook it up. And, but I do like the film shows us that Ben's the guy to call. Cause he was, I'm assuming in the ROTC is what it said on the thing.
Like in high school. Yeah. And then, you know, he was in the military. He knew, like, he didn't know where he was. So he went to Ben's mom's place.
His mom.
Right. Yeah. Which means they really did know each other. I mean, these aren't just acquaintances, like they knew each other, you know?
Yeah.
And man, Dwight nailed it. Ben is the guy.
He really is, man. I think it would have been really interesting to see if Ben stayed in the story past the moment, but I understand why it was decided that Dwight would continue the rest of it. But Ben is he's the guy to call. And I like that we kind of see Ben's moral compass a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, like he kind of understands what Dwight's trying to do and trying to achieve. But at the same time, he even says, like, you know, dude, like, what's to stop me from calling the cops right now?
Yeah.
Like, and I think he doesn't because, I mean, he even says it. I would probably be doing the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And again, like, yeah, you're right. Ben has this moral code in a way, that even when, what is his name? Sorry, it's the guy in the trunk. Teddy. Thank you. When Teddy's about to shoot Dwight, and Ben, you know, blows his head off. He was like, sorry, man, I had to wait for him to point at you. So it's legal, you know?
Yeah. So on the off chance this gets investigated, he can say like, oh, it was self-defense. He was about to kill my buddy.
Yeah. You know, not that it would probably ever be investigated, but I like that, you know, Ben is willing to help out, but to a certain extent, which again, lends to this realism that, you know, Ben's just not like 100% in, you know, mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, dude, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I got you. It's not a problem. Like, well, I'll kill anybody you want, whatever. Like, it's.
Yeah. It's not a Sam Rockwell Iron Man 2 situation where he's laying out guns. Like, oh, you want to blow someone up? All right, here, you know.
Exactly. He's saying, listen, man, if you need this, I got you. Like, don't tell me any more information. And, you know, whatever. Like, you can stay on my property for a while. It's not a big deal, you know.
And I love that Dwight actually does ask some of the right questions, like when they're putting Teddy's body back into the trunk, you know, Ben's like, you know, come on, man, I don't want him on my property. Well, what about the rest of his head? Oh, coyotes will get that. It's fine.
Yeah.
Just as long as he has no teeth.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
But yeah, you know, I do find it. But again, like I mentioned a second ago, I do find it interesting that they decide to sort of sideline Ben after this, you know, because Dwight sabotages his truck. Because I think somewhere deep down, I think he knew that Ben would kind of see this through, maybe not agree with it, but see it through with Dwight,
right,
and help him out.
And Dwight's not willing to let anyone else in on this. Right. It's bad enough he had to go to Ben in the first place, but he was really in a jam. Right. I think that if if he could have done this by himself, he would have, of course, because he doesn't want to get anybody else involved. He's done enough damage. And I think that's starting to sink in at this point that Dwight is really needing to end this for good. Right. We can't continue this cycle. It needs to be over. Because, you know, it's easy to see that it's never going to end, you know? And again, that speech, I mean, ironically, the speech that Ben gives him is to, you know, no speeches, don't hesitate. If you point the gun, you shoot it, you know? And again, good advice. especially in like the realm of just movies in general, like that's always good advice.
I would say again, more modern, as I just already mentioned, that John Wick, you know, when do you ever see John Wick giving a speech before he pulls the trigger?
No, dude,
he's just, you know, gung fu over here.
Yeah, exactly. It's yeah. I mean, if you want it done, get it done. Right. And that's eventually what gets him, because while he's at that house, you know, he buries Teddy, right? He doesn't have to do that. Right. But again, it's just this acknowledgement. I either read something or it was a video I watched. It's an act of contrition, right? He's starting to feel bad for all of this, right? It's again starting to sink in that this wasn't right. You know, he's not willing to sacrifice anybody else, himself or anybody else included, to further this vengeance, right? To further this revenge. And
yes.
What I also like, this scene or the sequence in particular, you know, has the great sequence of him taking all the guns out of the house, which takes a while, right? This place is stocked with guns, and this is kind of where the anti-gun thing comes in.
Well, and also I think he wanted to have a leg up.
Well,
you know, just in case. Yeah, I mean, no, but I agree. You know, because it did seem kind of odd that he wouldn't kind of hoard this arsenal for himself. Instead, he gets rid of all the guns.
Yeah.
But yeah, of course, another part of it is to have a leg up on them. Like, well, you have no guns. I'm the only one with a gun.
Right.
And of course, he misses two. Yeah. But two versus like the 10. That he found, I think those were good odds.
It was so many. And again, yes, in terms of the plot, the narrative, like the story elements, yes, that's exactly what he's doing. He's trying to get a leg up. He's trying to eliminate all other guns from the house. He's the only one with the weapon. He's calling the shots. Okay. That's what he wants. Mm-hmm. Looking at it in an analysis standpoint and looking at it as a viewer, right? We're seeing all of these weapons and all of these opportunities for violence, right? In the hands of these people that have zero problem, you know, using them towards an enemy, right? It's sort of, and him taking them away is sort of like apart from his, of course, but you know, it's sort of another representation of him trying to end the cycle of violence by just taking that opportunity away.
Right. Yeah. I agree. He misses two, which is, I mean, to be expected, because there were a lot. I don't think he ever would have found the one underneath the recliner.
Never. Who would have thought, you know?
Yeah. Although I want to say, I wish they would have shown us where William found that shotgun, that double-barreled shotgun. Because that's interesting that he missed a shotgun.
Well, like it could have been in the car they came in, right?
Oh, that's true. That's
true. It was probably like in the vehicle.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he obviously that would have been impossible to get. So, yeah.
Everyone come inside. Let me go out to your car and get you that shotgun. Yeah. But the final literally 10 minutes of the movie is so interesting because, you know, he's having this conversation with William with, I looked it up. It was Hope. And I didn't know the other woman's name.
No, I don't
either. But, you know, they're having this conversation and, you know, all he wants for them to do is just say to leave his sister out of it. Mm. She has nothing to do with this. Leave her out of it. Because I think he knows either A, I'm going to kill you both, or B, you're going to kill me, or C, we're going to kill each other. But just leave her out of this and we'll end this together. And I do like that William kind of gets the drop on him, but doesn't have it in him to kill him.
Right.
You know, which, you know, Hope and the other lady are like, you know, blow his head off, but he can't do it. You know, yeah, I'm sure.
And again, very profound moment. This is, you know, William is the end of all of this cycle, right? William is willing to let it go. And I think, and it's very important that he belongs to both sides of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course that's completely on purpose that, you know, it took someone who's got each foot on either side of this to just drop it. Drop it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and, you know, it makes me wonder, too, if maybe, because I'm sure Wade's family knows where William comes from. And it makes me wonder if maybe they treated him as an outsider.
Of course.
Within the family. So, and, you know, maybe he already doesn't have a loyalty to this family that's mm-hmm. raised him. And, you know, he doesn't understand why this one, or he does understand why this guy is trying to kill his family, but. You know, but it makes me wonder if maybe that's why William was so easily able just to let this go.
Yeah, I think that's got to be.
I have no loyalty to y'all.
No,
you've treated me like shit all my life. Why would I kill this guy when it seems like you guys have got it coming?
Yeah,
in a way. But yeah, no, I do find it interesting that it is sort of kind of coming full circle. With what started this all of Dwight's father having an affair, the offspring of that affair is the one that ends the cycle.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Because, you know, as we expected or maybe theorized, they kill each other. Dwight. Mm-hmm. Well, Dwight only kills one of the ladies because the other lady accidentally kills her sister or whatever. And then kills the other lady. And they kill each other, but, you know, it's the movie doesn't necessarily have a happy ending, but it has, I guess, a hopeful ending with we see William walking away.
Yeah.
And
I mean, Blue Ruin means tragedy anyway.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what does Blue Ruin mean?
It means tragedy. And so, like. No, it was never going to be a happy ending for anybody, right? I guess perhaps for William, right? There's a happy ending there. There's some closure with Sam, even though it comes at the price of another loss, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at least Sam will, again, have some closure. So,
yeah.
Not fully. And her brother's gone now, too. So.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, you know, it was such a interesting revenge story, you know. Like I was telling my assistant manager about it today. I was like, you know, it's a bit of a slow burn of a revenge movie. You know, it's not like we kind of get sort of like a gear up moment, you know, of Dwight, you know, packing up his stuff to drive to Pennsylvania or Pittsburgh to find Wade. And then, you know, we get the whole sequence with Ben going through all the different kind of guns and stuff like that.
Well, and it, especially with what we believe to be the full scope of the revenge and the vengeance and the plan, it happens so fast, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're, you know, maybe 20 minutes into this movie and he's killed the guy he wanted to, you know?
Yeah.
And that's when you're sort of, as an audience member, you're like, wait, I don't understand. You know, like, I thought this was going to be the whole thing, was going to be him trying to find Wade. And so once Wade's dead, you're just like, I don't know what to expect now. You know, of course, it's the aftermath of that. But yeah, and then there's that moment at the very, very end where Sam finally receives the postcard. Mm-hmm. Right? As if to say that all of this happened in such a short amount of time, you know, because he sent that postcard before he got to Wade. And that all happened in the time it took for her to receive that postcard.
Yeah, because doesn't she say it takes like a couple extra days for a postcard to
come something in? Like that. Yeah. So all this happened in just a couple of days. Man, I wish I had remembered what he said on the postcard.
I meant to rewind and go back.
It was something like an apology, right? And sort of a confession, like I'm sorry that I'm doing this, but here's what I'm, something like that. And again, I guess it's sort of closure for Sam in that sense as well, right? Getting that postcard. But I think that, at least for me as an audience member, for me watching it, it was sort of like, wow, that all of this did not take very long.
As we're most, you know, like, again, I'm going to bring up You Were Never Really Here. You know, that happens over the course of months, right?
Or weeks. It takes some time. I mean, that also might be a couple of days. Yeah.
But I mean, even, you know, I'm going to use John Wick as an example. Even with John Wick, like that 4-part revenge plan takes place over months for him. And, you know, and supposedly it's still not over, you know, but we'll see. But yeah, you know, it is interesting that this very almost intimate revenge story only takes like 3 days.
It is sort of an intimate revenge story. You're definitely right. It's a slow burn for sure. But it's never boring.
No, absolutely not.
You're on the edge of your seat the whole time because you just need to know what's going to happen, you know, to poor Dwight. It's an awesome, awesome movie. I saw it not at the theater, but I saw it when it came out. I guess it was 2013. And probably I rented it from a Hastings, which is now an old fashioned sentence.
I was about to say, I'm like, does anyone know what Hastings is anymore?
I rented it from a Hastings because I was living in San Marcos, and I remember it blew me away. I couldn't believe how good it was. Again, I was probably just taken by the realism. I was taken by, you know, its intimacy. Just Dwight, the character, I was just, you know, in awe of that performance. And of course I was excited because, you know, I was like, oh, the director's name is Jeremy and the main actor's last name is Blair. That's kind of fun.
I'm in this movie.
Jeremy Blair. In it, you know, let's pop this in. But no, and of course, like every time that either of their names pop up on anything, I get excited. Macon is writing and I believe directing the new Toxic Avenger film that's coming out soon.
Yes, I think I look at that. So yes, I believe he is.
That's going to be bananas. I can't wait for that. Saulnier, he did Green Room. I think he did Hold the Dark, which I didn't see, but that's with Jeffrey Wright. I think it's on Netflix. And I don't know what he's doing coming up, but it's probably going to be awesome. If these are any indication, then yeah, he's got a couple of things. I'm looking at his IMDb right now. He's got Rebel Ridge, which looks to be, it says action thriller. And yeah, so we'll see how that goes. But anyway, huge fans of these guys. This was a great introduction to both of them. And again, Macon Blair has been in a ton of stuff, and he was recently just in Oppenheimer. So he's getting some right, gigs. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I also loved the movie. You know, I watched it on Prime. Unfortunately, it's part of their freebie thing, so I had ads. Oof. But thankfully, they put their ads in moments where it wasn't like in the middle of a scene where something was happening. It was during more of like more of the quiet scenes, like of Dwight driving or, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
But it was still, it still blew me away. Now it makes me want to see Green Room even more now.
Definitely.
Cause yeah, it's down there somewhere. Cause I lucked out and I got one with the slipcase.
That I did see in the theater, and that was just like, it was a really cool experience because it was just surprise after surprise after twist. It was so good. Oh,
there it is. I found it.
Good.
Yeah. But yeah. Yeah, man. It was, I really enjoyed this. It didn't feel like an hour and a half. It felt like it was 2 hours long, and I enjoyed every minute of
it. In a good way, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, in a good way. In a good way. But yeah. So Jeremy, are you ready to wrap up?
Yeah. Obviously it's great. If you haven't seen it, go for it. I know we ruined it, but you know, it's still worth a watch. yeah, God, it's so good. You gotta see it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really good. Really, really good. Like we mentioned, you can watch it on Prime, or if you want to own it physically. I know I saw some Blu-ray copies on Amazon.
Nice.
That's the only reason why I didn't buy it is because they were a little overpriced. Mm-hmm. So I was like, you know what? I can watch it on Prime for free.
Yeah.
Not a big deal. Okay. But yeah. So, well, everyone, it is time, as it is for every season, to prepare for the end of season series. So, Jeremy, would you like to know what we're doing, even though I know you know what we're doing?
I know what we're doing. You go ahead.
So this season, it is my pick for the end of season series. And I decided that we're going to do something a little interesting. We are going to do a deep dive into quality in terms of what happens when a series of films declines in quality, meaning not the films are going to get worse and worse and worse. They're just going to get a little bad every now and then.
It kind of seems like they're going to get worse and worse.
And I decided to choose a film series that I think we can all agree, even though I've had heated discussions with my mother that this doesn't happen, that we can all agree from the first movie to the second movie, there's definitely a decrease in quality. So Jeremy, next week we'll start our end of season series on The Matrix. This has definitely been a long time coming. I am super excited to talk about the first Matrix film because I think it is phenomenal. I think it's genre breaking. You know, it never gets old. But then once we get to Reloaded, and then Revolutions, and now Resurrections, there's this kind of decline.
Oh man, you know, up until this moment, by the way, I forgot there were four. So I was like, oh, it's only three. I can handle three. And I'm like, oh no, there's four. And
And well, and I could be, and I could be a real asshole, and we can do the Animatrix.
I remember that.
Even though those are actually really fucking good, but we're not going to do the Animatrix because technically they're like sub stories, and so it doesn't really matter.
So
yeah, it's not with the lore. But no, I am really excited to talk about this because I do want to see your opinion because you've never watched anything past the first Matrix film, right?
Yeah, I've only seen the first one, and that was forever ago. I mean, I might as well have not seen it at all.
So I am really interested in to see what you have to say because, like I said, I've had heated discussions with my mother about the most recent film, Resurrections, because I think I don't think it's the worst. Three is the worst, but we'll get there. But four, it's not as good as what everyone says it was. But again, we'll get there.
So, all right. So since we're at the end of this episode, we're at the end of the series, right?
Uh-huh.
Here's something fun that I want to mention because either you don't care. Or okay. You haven't noticed, because I'm going to quit doing it after today. I have been wearing the same gray shirt for every episode.
I mean, I have noticed, but I have, but I haven't. Like, I'm like, oh, he's wearing a gray shirt. Cool.
Yeah.
But it hasn't crossed my mind that it's the same one.
It's the same. It's so I've been wearing the same shirt. It's technically two shirts. It's like child actors. I have two of them just so, you know, one doesn't work more than the other. with child labor laws. But I'm like, you know, like when we first like log on to these things, and it's so dumb. I was like, you know what? I'm going to do something really stupid. I'm just going to wear the same shirt. For those people who watch on YouTube or whatever, like they're going to be like, is he, or maybe they don't care, you know? And that's also, I'm willing to take that risk, for it not mattering at all. And it doesn't, but I'm like, I wonder if he's going to notice I'm wearing the same shirt every day or every week.
And now Future Rain's gonna have to make a super cut of, and it's just gonna be called The Gray Shirt. And yeah. I actually kind of current rain kind of wants to do that. I think that sounds like fun, but
sure, yeah. If you go back to like on Instagram, I put like a screenshot of us.
That's
you can
right.
see my gray shirts on.
That's right. Oh my god. That's amazing.
And your shirt is never the same, and then you know there's just mine. So
maybe that'll be the thing. Maybe we'll trade off each season. So next season I'll wear the same shirt every week.
Sure. I had mentioned it to you before, just offhanded. It was during our Burton and Lang thing that we did. And I just in passing, I was like, wouldn't it be funny if I just wore the same shirt every week? And I didn't do it. And this time I was like, I'm not going to tell him. I'm just going to keep doing it.
Dude, I wonder, I'm sure Zach, you're going to have to tell us if you clocked it.
I broke it to him halfway through. I was like, hey, buddy, I need to tell somebody I'm doing this instead of Haley. Cause Haley obviously knows. Cause I would go, oh, it's time for the podcast. Got to go put my shirt on. Put my gray shirt on, and which was great because I never had to worry about what I was wearing for the show.
Yeah, I try not to worry about what I'm wearing, but then other times I'm like I have that. I sent you a picture of it. That other shirt I bought from Disney, that button up that has like 2024 all over it. I want to wear it, but it's a button up collared shirt, and I'm like, I don't want to look fancy for the podcast. Like,
so if next week for the Matrix, I'm wearing the gray shirt, it's because I forgot. It's because I forgot. And I'm like, I guess I'm going to keep doing it. But yeah. So as of right now, I'm probably going to quit doing it.
Okay.
But it was fun. It was a long run. I did, you know, however many episodes it was.
I don't remember. That's a Future Rain thing.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Well, everyone, we We hope you enjoyed this episode on Blue Ruin, and we will see you next week for part one of our end of season series, The Matrix.